Hello, my name is Abraham Kim, Vice President of the Korea Economic Institute. I want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in every couple of weeks to enjoy our podcast, The Korean Context, for the last 13 months with our host, Martha Legatsky. As you know, Martha recently left us to pursue a career in law. But we at the Institute are excited to introduce our newest host, Chad O'Carroll, KAI's new Director of Communications. We are ever committed to bringing you the same high quality and fascinating interviews with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers that bridge Korea and the U.S. But as you will hear, Chad will bring his own unique flavor and perspective. I am sure you will not be disappointed. We hope you enjoy. And as always, we love to hear from you. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name is Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. Well, today I'm in the studio with Curtis Melvin. He's a doctoral student at the George Mason University here in Washington, D.C. He also runs nkeconwatch.com. It's a blog which is one of the longest running North Korea websites out there on the internet to date. He's also well known for North Korea Uncovered. It's a Google mapping project which made front page news in the Wall Street Journal back in 2009. Exposing labor camps, some of Kim Jong-il's coolest hangouts, and a number of underground airports, it's not hard to see why it got the attention it did when it first surfaced in the media. So Curtis, just to start out, I'd like to ask about your interest in North Korea. You've been to a pretty interesting range of countries, Myanmar, Turkmenistan, Iran, and even Zimbabwe. What was it about North Korea that initially got your interest?
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I was very lucky as a child to have lived in Europe and when I was in high school. And my father took us on a lot of travels, including to the Soviet Union and former Warsaw Pact countries. And one evening in Czechoslovakia, I made friends at a social gathering with an East German gentleman. And he gave me an East German 2 Ostmark coin that was made out of aluminum, and I could bend it in half with my fingers. And after that evening, we drove back across the Iron Curtain into, I believe, Austria. And it always struck me how sad it was that that Iron Curtain separated the Czechs and the Austrians and divided Europe. And that sort of has stayed with me as I studied economics and traveled more growing up, so that when I was in Asia and traveling around and planning my route, as I picked up a guidebook that had a chapter in it on North Korea. And when I started to read it, it reminded me of those emotions I had about the socialist system when I was traveling in it.
Now, your website has been running since 2006 and is one of the most visited North Korea blogs on the internet. What do you think made it so popular initially, and what do you think that people find most useful about it?
When I began the webpage, there were not as many internet-based sources for finding news on the DPRK. I'm happy to say that that interest in the country has grown tremendously, and now major news organizations are writing much more content about the DPRK. Many more students seem to be taking an interest in the country, and so it's not the sort of isolated little corner of the internet that it used to be. I think part of the reason that the site has received the attention it has is because I was lucky enough to sort of start early and get into the game before many other people. And additionally, I decided early on that it wasn't going to be a platform for me to espouse my own opinion so much as creating a place where researchers could go and easily find material on a vast array of subjects related to the DPRK that might otherwise just be dispersed somewhere out there on the internet.
Mm-hmm. In recent months, we've seen quite a lot of talk on your website about people working on North Korea receiving viruses, being victims of hacking, and so on and so forth. Have you or your website received any such attacks?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not alone in this category. Just about everyone who has a North Korean focused webpage or who does research on North Korea or any sort of policy work on North Korea or NGO work or even journalists, all seem to have been, literally everyone I can think of seems to have been targeted at least once. And it's been very efficient in the sense that their research into who to target has been very thorough. Surprisingly, the targets are not classifiable by any sort of politics. They fall across the political spectrum. They're not identifiable by any national characteristics. Again, they fall on all the continents. I've heard of cases from everywhere except I guess Africa and Antarctica, and the latter having a pretty reasonable reason why. But it's been very thorough and persistent. It started back in 2010, and the most recent round of attacks was just a couple of months ago. So if you're listening to this podcast, just remember to keep an eye out for suspicious emails. Don't open attachments from people you don't know, even PDF documents, and don't click on links from emails with poor grammar.
Moving on to your map project, this is arguably what you're best known for. Well, Wall Street Journal did a front page piece in 2009 on it. What motivated you to set up the maps overlay?
I initially started out the project mapping out places that I had been to or wanted to go to. And I wasn't the only person who had seen the Google Earth imagery of North Korea, and some other people had posted things that I also did not know about. So I just began collecting it all together. And since I read a lot of North Korean, propaganda and publications, they feature their economic projects very prominently, and so I began to take an interest in trying to find those as well. And it really is just – it's something that built up over months and months and months. And as I posted different versions of it online, different people would contact me and say, you know, I just went to North Korea and I visited this factory and here's where it is. Or I stayed in this guest house and this is what it's called and this is where it is. And so it was great to get a project started that involved so many different people from so many different places contributing and verifying and correcting the information and helping to put together a thorough source. And now it's really great now because just about every place that's mentioned in the North Korean media we can almost entirely point to satellite imagery of.
So
we can see, you know, which facilities are in fact being improved, which ones are being torn down.
Now, a common criticism put to tourists returning from North Korea is what they've seen is been heavily choreographed. They've only been shown the best parts of the country, so on and so forth. From your work on the maps and, you know, the new locations that have opened up, Hamhung, Chongqing, and so on, do you think that tourists to North Korea are now getting a fairly accurate portrayal of life there, or it's still very blinkered in terms of what they see?
I think that the North Korean government still does and tries to put on a very good show for foreigners. And what you see when you go there is not typical of the life, the everyday life of the everyday person. That being said, I don't think that the North Korean government is really very good at painting an ideal picture. They try to, but there's a lot of cracks in it, and they can't, you know, hide or explain everything. I remember when I was there in 2005 on my second trip. This was right after they had rounded up the, not right after, but they had recently rounded up the cell phones that had only just started to be issued a couple years earlier after the Yongchun train explosion. And so I was trying to find out from the guides, what happened to the cell phones and why did you collect them all? And the most anyone would tell me was it was related to security. And we were at a couple days later, we were at a mass rally near the charter for the three charters for the statue, the three charters of national reunification, the two women, two giant statues of women.
Yeah.
And there was a girl there who pulled a cell phone out of her purse, and it was wrapped in this nice little silk doily, and she talked on her phone for a few seconds and then wrapped it back up in the silk and put it back in her purse. And I tapped my guide on the arm with my elbow and I said, "You see that girl over there?" She goes, "Yeah." And I was like, "She's got a cell phone in her purse." And she goes, "Really?" And I was like, "Yeah. She just got off. She's got it wrapped in silk in her purse." And the guide said, "Oh, she must be a special person. I'm just an ordinary person." And that was just one little anecdote of little cracks in the perfect veil they try to put it. So it's worth going there, even if you know what you're expecting, to sort of see these little cracks in the system.
Now, in terms of cell phones, the rise in usage of these has been pretty meteoric in recent months. I think there are now over 500,000 people signed up to the network. From your understanding of the country, do you think these users of the cell phones are likely to be a lot more affluent than the general population, or are cell phones really starting to permeate into general society a bit more?
What's been interesting for me to learn about all this is, yes, I think that the cell phones are primarily for affluent people right now. But we can verify on Google Earth the growth of the cell phone network. We know what the Orascom, the Koryolink cell phone towers look like. And with the new Google Earth imagery, we can see them actually appearing on mountainsides now. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to rely just on Orascom data to confirm the link, the size of the actual phone network. The second point is that we rely very heavily on, shall I say, not very great per capita income data when we're assessing the DPRK.
Right.
And so it's really hard to get a sense of what the average North Korean's economic capabilities are. With that in mind, the third point is, all of these North Koreans, these over half a million North Koreans now that have cell phone contracts, are paying for them in hard currency. And that's just staggering to believe that there's so many people with hard currency. You know, it turns out that everyone uses hard currency whenever they can to save now. But before this venture was launched, I would have never thought there would be so many North Koreans that could afford those kinds of bills in hard currency.
There's been a lot of talk recently about special economic zones being set up in cooperation with the Chinese. At the same time, this isn't really a new idea, and special economic zones like the one in Rason haven't been faring very well. Do you think the North Korean regime is likely to make the concessions required to allow any future, especially economic zones, to operate efficiently?
That's a really interesting question. I'm, in a sense, I'm kind of in favor of these economic zones being driven by market demand rather than government subsidy. So in this sense, the government of North Korea has to strike credible deals with foreign investors, and foreign investors have to be coaxed into putting their own capital on the line in North Korea without fear of expropriation of their assets, and feeling confident that they can repatriate their profits as well. And it's these sorts of policies of credibility of contract enforcement and repatriation of profits that the North Koreans need to build. And in the absence of that market discipline, they're really not going to face a hard incentive to develop those institutions.
And I mean, what is there as incentive for investors? Why North Korea? I mean, what are the material advantages?
The only advantage I'm aware of is the one that everyone knows about, which is cheap labor. And it's sad to think that we should be encouraging people to go there to pay very low wages to unskilled and semi-skilled workers. But North Korean people are victims of their government, and North Korean people have dignity and they want to work. And I think that that for certain kinds of exports, it would be great if entrepreneurs from the West could reach agreements with the North Korean government to allow firms to go in and set up these kinds of factories, which often receive a lot of negative press in the West and would receive much more from setting up shop in North Korea. But they would give North Korean workers more options. They would raise the standard of living in North Korea for ordinary people. And those are things that I think are beneficial for everyone.
Okay, now I'd just like to cast your mind back to 2009, when North Korea embarked on what was widely regarded as a hugely disastrous monetary reform. With the advantage of 2 years hindsight, do you think these reforms can be viewed as a success or failure by the government in Pyongyang?
Well, these kinds of monetary reforms happened all the time in the Soviet Union, and have happened, I think, 4 times before in the DPRK. These socialist systems have to have these kinds of monetary reforms because the way the system is set up, the system requires people, in order for there to be monetary balance in the standard sort of communist economic system, it requires that workers deposit their pay in state-owned banks, the amount that they don't spend on their consumption every period. And nobody does that. The money ends up sitting in people's houses. And so they cause an imbalance in the currency and inevitable inflation, because there's more currency outstanding than there are goods to purchase with that currency. And so they have to do these monetary reforms every now and then. I think this one was unique in the sense that they did not announce it in advance.
Right.
And that most monetary reforms were announced in advance. And they put a very low limit on the total amount of funds that could be converted to the new currency. So they dressed up an old familiar policy tool and tried to use it, I believe, as a new policy tool for reducing the wealth holdings of of non-favored political classes. And I think that they were successful in doing that.
Yeah.
So if the goal was to disenfranchise a number of market participants who weren't particularly well connected or weren't ready for it, then it worked very well. If the goal was to halt inflation, it did very poorly because since North Korea now has market prices, not just administered prices, when the currency was reformed, people immediately lost faith in the new currency. The government could not commit to a lower price level, and people immediately forecast new inflation into the new price level and wiped out any sort of inflation gains that they could expect.
And have prices stabilized now, or are they still high comparative to before?
My understanding is that the general price level is about where it was before the currency reform.
Okay, now just to round up, as an economist, do you think the sanctions regime is currently being effective at achieving its stated goals against North Korea?
I think that, you know, the literature that I've read in economics generally expresses a skepticism that economic sanctions lead to political change in dictatorships. And when they're successful, they prevent the inflow of a certain amount of resources, and then those resources are simply diverted from people who are further down the food chain to people who are further up the food chain in dictatorships. And so I've always been fairly skeptical of sanctions really having any kind of effect at changing policies in North Korea. There's something to be said for non-proliferation kinds of sanctions, and that's a different game entirely. I'm speaking just about economic sanctions and economic policies. So I don't think, though, that that they've been particularly effective at keeping. I can't speak about proliferation activities, but I think that anyone who goes to North Korea would see a number of prohibited goods on display. I think the North Koreans actually put them out there for people to see and take pictures of. A recent visitor took a picture of a 2008 Hummer parked in the parking lot in front of the Yonggakdo Hotel, and that was just a nice little gesture I think they made to the West. So you know, the border with China is long and porous. The DPRK has a bunch of coastline. It's not hard to get things in and out if you have the right papers.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your time, Curtis. If you're interested in checking out the blog that Curtis runs, make sure you visit nkeconwatch.com. It's updated regularly and features some really interesting information on North Korea, so I'd really recommend you check it out. And you can also find information on how to download his Google Maps overlay, North Korea Uncovered, which again I'd suggest is worth a look. So yeah, thanks for listening to Korea Context, and I do hope you can join us for another episode soon. For more information about this episode, the podcast, and forthcoming KEI events, do visit our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. If you have any questions, comments, or podcast tips you'd like to suggest to me, drop me a note at ocarroll@keia.org. It's been a real pleasure to have you listen today, and I do look forward to joining us next time for another episode of Korean Context. Thank you and good day.